When are we not joyous, not at ease? What results in difficulties for us? What impedes our relations and functioning? Look closely. What's occurring when we are sure life is difficult? Things shouldn't be the way they are. Often it's because we believe, are sure, that certain persons, events, conditions, circumstances are not the way they ought to be and are the cause of our problems, our suffering. Problems and suffering, of course, broad general words, and usually we're much more specific about that. Just as we are much more specific about the conditions, if I say it, the characteristics of the beings and the confluence of circumstances that are the source, S-O-U-R-C-E, the source, not sauce in my New York accent, the source of our difficulties. The fourth practice that this text of Bodhidharma speaks of is the practice of being in accord with the Dharma. That means being in accord with the nature of this life that we are. Or if I say it a different way, being in accord with the very nature that all natures, all that we encounter is pure, all appearances are empty, empty of fixed, separate, permanent self, permanent characteristics. That, if I say it more, that they don't exist as we see them. Therefore, and that even includes any what we would call attachments and defilements, things that are not okay, about them. They're all insubstantial or non-substantial. Whereas if you looked at what causes us difficulties, it is we because often we are sure, we believe in the substantiality of certain characteristics, phenomena, things, events, persons. See, and being in accord with the Dharma is seeing that they are without this and that. See? No self or non-self, non-sentient beings or non-separate fixed beings, fixed self. In the Dharma, no sentient beings, free of any impurities of sentient beings. In the Dharma, no self, free of the impurity. One whose insight enables them to see and understand this can practice in accord with the Dharma, meaning accord with the nature of the way it is, the way reality. Or to go back, remember, this is the fourth that connects us back to the beginning, which is the entrance of principle, which is being awakened to the truth that all beings, all that we encounter, are, share, if I say it that way, this same true nature that is empty of any fixed characteristics. Therefore, the text says, you're able to comprehend the three voidnesses. By that it means able, let's see a better way to translate that, the three emptinesses, if I use that word. In other words, being able to give body, life, and possessions without regret, because you understand that the recipient, the giver, and what's given are all non-substantial. Non-substantial means that there's no fixed characteristics, which is the source of difficulties, of attachments and reactions to it. See? When I asked you to look at what causes difficulties, I don't know what you came up with, but often it's because we believe in the substantiality, the fixedness, the separateness of the conditions and functioning of all sorts of beings, whether it's ourself or others, others whom we have difficulty with. Usually we people have difficulty with people, much less so with inanimate objects. Though when we bump into something, we can often curse it and get angry at it for being where it is, as if it got in our way. I'm sure I'm not the only one who's noticed that that's possible. But maybe I am. Maybe none of you have ever had that. But certainly we have difficulties when others are that way. We certainly don't have great difficulty with the way they are, the things they have, and the way we are. The text says, understanding the three non-substantialities, one neither swerves from action or becomes attached to things, but rids himself of his own defilements, attachments, and beliefs, and aids in the liberation of all other beings, all without grasping at characteristics, without conceptualizing self and other. See, self and other, another way of speaking of what this being in accord with the Dharma is, or this being in accord with the principle of seeing grasping for ourself, realizing and awakening to the same true nature that we share with all beings. The text goes on to speak of this enables us to practice all the six paramitas, the six virtues, the first of which is giving, which is easily connected to the giver, what's given, and the receiver all being empty and yet being able to manifest and function in giving because of that, out of that. And all the other of the paramitas, I know you all know of them, but I'll repeat them just for the sake. And though you might know them in Sanskrit or in another language, they're giving is the first, the second is morality or moral behavior, it's dana and sila or shila, forbearance or patience, striving or vigor, then dhyana, which is meditation, and the last is prajna or insight, wisdom. Those are the six paramitas, the six, what should I call them, perfections of action that enable us, that manifest who we are and enable us to clarify inaccurate delusions, and despite doing this, one is not caught up in practicing anything extra special. This both supports being in accord with the Dharma being in accord with this one true nature that we are, and at the same time manifests. So, what I started with is asking, what causes us difficulties, suffering, unease, troubles, all the various words that we use, which are based on what we believe about others, about characteristics, about ourself, about our conditions. And when we can see that holding attachment to the way we are sure it is, the way our life is being disturbed by those, right there is the opportunity to make this effort of practicing in accord with the Dharma, not because we're going to superimpose something, but because we enter exactly where we're caught up and believe appearances to be as they are, as we say they are, rather than as they are. Believe what I'll use the word that they use, though it's a strange word for our ears, the defilements about them, the subject-object life story, the attachment to how they should or shouldn't be. See, the characteristics that we sure are theirs, that we are sure are the cause of the difficulty and are their identifying marks, and that if only they would change those characteristics, then they would be better and we would be happy. So this is the fourth of the practices that Bodhidharma sets forth in this text as both manifesting the way and enabling us, if I say it this way, to make the practice effort to clear the thickets that blind and hinder, that entangle us from being who we are and being this joyous life that we are. Now, many of you have heard this phrase of the emptiness of the three, whether it's in terms of the dana or charity, the emptiness of recipient, donor, and gift. And in a way, it's also what we allude to in our meal verse, receiving the gift of food and yet seeing its nature for what it is. We can receive it and appreciate it and, in a sense, liberate ourselves, the food, and all that are offering the food to us. Liberate us to be who we are. See, that's what liberation is. Not to give us something extra, but to enable us to be, to awaken and manifest this same true nature that we all are, and to release without releasing, not being blinded by the delusions and misperceptions. So we can explore this a little bit together now. If you need to change your position to be more comfortable, please do. So this basic text is a fairly short text, and as I said, this is the earliest what we could call Zen or Chan texts. In some ways it's more elaborate than shorter koan, and in some ways each phrase and each of the various parts are themselves a koan, are themselves the, if I use the word, the genjo koan, the koan of our life to manifest this realized life we are. So I'll stop and see if some of you have something that you want to say, or if you noticed some interesting answers to the first questions that I posed about what, where disturbance and difficulties come from, and what light might be shed on those. Galinda.
Well, I just realized that, well, I have been working on judging, and I realized that that's what I was doing.
Yeah, judging, which we humans really like to do, is all based on believing the characteristics and the separate subject-object world. Because we hold that as the basis to judge, whether we're judging ourselves or others, and then being sure of who and what they are, because those characteristics are, quote, fixed in some ways, even if it's fixed in an event where they behaved in such a da-da-da-da-da. And therefore that justifies us to do A, B, C to them, and or to feel A, B, C about them, or, and you can, because we all can see that. Sometimes we're judging ourselves and believing stories and characteristics about ourselves. See this, it's very easy to hear a word like empty or void, or whatever word they want to use for shunyata, or and to hear it but not to make, be able to make any specific connection to our everyday life with those words. See? But when we can start seeing where we are taking what's not fixed as fixed, as permanent, as separate, as defining of, as a basis for attachment or despising, which are both forms of the same thing, then we can see what happens from that, which means we suffer, they suffer, harm is sometimes done, whether to us or them, doesn't make a difference.
So in seeing this person as empty,
yes,
I now understand how just sitting with them would make most sense.
And empty doesn't mean that we're not, if I use it this way, subject to cause and effect, ongoing change, ongoing interdependent change. And yet it's empty. We are empty of any fixed substantiality of this way or that. Therefore, it makes sense to use the word that's translated here, without defilement, because those are the basis of how we believe, quote, people are defiled. That's why this text talks about intrinsic purity of all. Everyone you encounter. Purity is a hard word for us in our culture. We don't use words like that. Except when you're talking about products that you're trying to sell someone. Then you tell them it's 100% pure. But we do it even without using those words when we judge.
Believing the stories.
Speak up a little louder.
Okay, so sometimes I'll notice the story, but I still think it. I don't want to rethink it, or overthink it. Just try to see if I can't fix it in my mind somehow, so I can come up with it. If I don't like what's happened, or I took some action, say, and I start to analyze it. Uh-huh. So there's this, I'll just call it overthinking about it, and that is very disruptive.
And also attaching to it when we try to fix it. We attach to it in a certain way. And we fix it in a different way. We make it fixed. So we fix it at a certain place, because then we say, okay, that's fixed that way, and therefore I need to fix it in the other sense of the word fixed. Fixed meaning it's permanent or has a certain solidity, substantiality, separateness that needs to be fixed, changed. It's interesting that the word fixed it can also be used in that sense of being in a certain place as in a certain way. See, fix things in space and time and in our judgment and in what characteristics they do or don't, quote, possess. See, and that's how do we then connect that with this non-substantialities of what we have, who we are, and who others are. See, not. We tend to get caught up in the distinctions between this and that, whereas this says being in accord with principle is not caught in the distinctions between this and that. That doesn't mean that they should pour sand in this cup for me to have tea with. That's not that kind of not caught in distinctions. When we want to drink, we put liquid in the cup. If there's sand in here, I'd look in and just leave it. But that isn't what we're talking about.
Earlier you said that attachment and despising are forms of the same thing.
Yes.
Could you clarify that?
When you despise something, someone, that's an attachment to that being a certain way and towards your beliefs about what is and isn't and should and shouldn't. Otherwise, what is there to despise? What's the basis of our despising or finding things, people, events despicable, which is the same one. See, can we see beings that we encounter as empty, meaning, if I explain it a different way, as the flow of cause and effect manifesting this moment without adding on our judgment about them as fixed, separate persons who are bad, good, not nice, nice, troublesome, etc., etc. That we do. And then we do things when we fix, add, attach, those stories about them, and we believe them. And then they make trouble for us, or we make trouble for them, or whatever. We then go on from there. Then we miss this, if I use the expression, this same true nature that we are encountering from morning to night, or this pure nature that all share, that all are, in the midst of coming and going and changes which are inherently non-substantial. So this isn't, you don't have to take any of these in terms of trying to figure them out as theories, but take it as practice, as seeing where holding on to characteristics creates difficulties. Very simple. Holding on to judgments creates suffering. Attachments and ideas of defilement result in upset. Someone trying to join us?
Yeah, it's your pet squirrel.
Did you want to say something besides that?
He has vigor.
Yeah, that's vigor. See, that's one of the six perfections. And it's true. Animals have perfections, manifest those perfections as well. Someone wanted to say something back there. Yeah.
So, when you say we, you're including yourself.
Of course. We means humans, means all of us humans.
So, I mean, I just ask you this because, I mean, you are the teacher. You have more advanced, you know, skill at this. But I just, uh-huh. You know, surely you were setting that example about knocking into something, stubbing your toe or whatever. I mean, surely you also say, damn. You know,
that's right. And you know what that is? It's a reactive habit that we're not present, but we're reacting.
So what I'm asking is, okay, so, you know, I know you have more experience with this. What do you do? How is it that you don't hang on to that?
You notice it when it's occurring. You are present in what you hear coming out of your mouth or arising in your head before you go on. Because otherwise, you go, damn, and you continue cursing because you do. I mean, well, let's say it this way. Some people do. And sometimes they then add on who's to blame for it being there and what they're going to do to that person or what they actually do say to that person because that's there. Or what they're going to do to that inanimate object because it dared to not function the way they wanted. You know, they'll smash it. Has anyone ever seen anything like that happen? So, reactive habits, in one sense, are cause and effect. We can't do... It's like I like to use the example of the traffic because it's so perfect. We can't do anything about what cars are going to show up. I mean, we can if we want to build a barrier down the block, but we're going to have trouble if we try to do that. So cars keep coming through. Just like reactive habits occur as part of our life until they don't, in the process of cause and effect, in the process of living our life. Reactive habits to circumstances. However, as when they arise, we can notice them. We can notice them before we act on them. We can notice them when they just appear in our, call it conscious or our awareness. Or we can notice them after we've begun acting them out, whether verbally or in other ways. Or we could keep on building at them and not notice them and just operate at the effect of them. When we operate at the effect of them, when we don't notice them, sooner or later, that creates harm and suffering for us and others. So, our task, if we're talking about practice, is to notice them as soon as we can. As you can't notice them before you notice them, but when you notice it, and when you've created the practice environment so that you notice it sooner, whether doing sesshin or whether being present throughout the activities of your life, then you can see how to practice skillfully with them. That's what these four practices, you know, we had first, the first text was the entrance by principle, and then there were the four means of practice. So we talked. So then you can practice, if we want to say, experiencing it. If you want to say you could notice what you're believing. If you want to say you can be bodily present. You can do other things. You can, we've talked about, you can turn and bow to the circumstance as a counter to the habit of wanting to curse it and smash it. No, I mean it. Sometimes that's what's necessary.
But you still have to do that too, right?
Some of the time, reactive habits occur, and when they occur, I have to do something that's appropriate for them. Hopefully, it's long before I've acted out of them, meaning getting angry, cursing, violence. That's all the things, some of the things, excuse me, that people do. Yes. See, if you can notice the reactive habit when it appears, then it just, you know, it appears just like the car. You can't do it. You don't, there's nothing that needs to be done until the car appears, and then it can continue up on the road and not be a big deal, as opposed to be notice it and then start getting angry about how dare them drive that car on my road, that color car, that shape car, that way they're driving, that and some people get out in the street and do things about the cars that they don't like appearing on their road, etc., etc. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess.
So it's a matter of seeing what's skillful and what's appropriate. That's the words I talked about a few days ago. Seeing what is, not because you have to keep thinking about it, but sort of it comes up automatically. What's skillful and appropriate right now? How to manifest. Sometimes nothing's needed, quote, consciously, except to see it. And right there's the experiencing of it, and it just dissipates.
Okay, but like I guess what I'm talking about is that like you can see that you can do that differently now than before, or maybe you don't even think about before.
Yeah,
maybe
I don't.
That's part of what goes on.
But before is another story. See, there's all sorts of befores. I mean it. You don't have If any of us were to try to talk about the before of our life last week, last month, last year, right now, it would be very different than, let's say, a year ago, talking about last week, last month, last year, because how we see befores is just a process, a product of right now, how we see right now. But that's just before stories. We don't need those befores. Befores is just a story. Sometimes it becomes a story to justify attachment and delusion and anger and beliefs. Often. So I don't find it that useful to talk about befores, except to see where and how it's a basis for attachment and confusion. Otherwise, befores are just stories. Stories we like to tell, they're fine, we can talk about them, but it's not much use if we get attached and caught up with stories. Then they're even further entanglements. They become chains that are around our ankle that keep us from being where we are now. They keep pulling us back into even more discriminative beliefs.
That's yet another attachment, right, to
those
old things.
Sure. I mean, there's people who talk about all the before stories about family members and friends who now they won't have contact with because, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. And sometimes they hold on to that up till the person's death and afterwards. And, you know, I won't go to their funeral because... da, 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 da. Or I won't go to that family function because 20, 30, 40 years ago such and such happened. I've heard this said by people. I don't know if anyone else here has heard such things, but people even come into Dokusan room and told me about how that occurs. So that's the sort of holding on to story that poisons the present moment and is a complete fiction. It's exactly what this is talking about, attachments to subjects and objects. Subjects and objects that are just there to cause suffering. See? And we could look in the world and see how much harm and suffering results from holding on to those sorts of things. Jeff, you wanted?
Yeah. Well, I have this habit of always having something that's troubling me. And,
what do you mean by that?
Well, let me give you this specific, perhaps.
Yeah.
Then you can tell me if really I should just talk about this in private instead of here. But I do want to say, we moved the cat scratching post, about a week ago, and I've stubbed my toe on it 3 times already.
Uh-huh. And I heard you say a word when you said we moved it.
Gretchen said, "Jeff, move that scratching post."
Oh, so it's even I moved it.
Yes. She even put it in my way. I put it in my way in the middle of the night when I get up to whatever, have my 4:30 a.m. coffee. I stub my toe.
Uh-huh. And then
I just say damn, but I don't blame it on anybody or anything. I don't blame it on the screen.
How many times will it take for you to move it from?
After this session, I won't
get
into it anymore.
Somewhere, I remember hearing a catchy definition of insanity when we keep doing the same thing despite the fact that it doesn't work.
Yeah. But here's my dilemma. I was invited by some friends, high school friends, who are very dear to me, who did come to, you know, my mother and brother's funerals and have kept in touch, and we had a wonderful 50th birthday party reunion in California where one of them lives 7 years ago. And I haven't seen them for several years, you know, since then, and they invited me to come to this event. And the event is totally, you know, not what I'm really interested in. They're going to go be in Clearwater, Tampa area, watching the Philadelphia Phillies train and go to exhibition games. And
mm-hmm.
I'm not really into sports, but I am into, would like to see these friends and have some, you know, catch up with them. And be
uh-huh.
But the long story short is, you know, it's somewhat costly. I'll have to not work for a couple of days. And so my mind goes, well, those three are wealthy and I'm poor. Those three, blah, 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 and I'm this. And I've kind of spun around this over and over again. Gretchen suggested that I just go and enjoy them. Yep. And I'm starting to think, well, there might be a bird refuge. Oh, there's a sandy beach. Oh, there's a museum somewhere.
Oh, wow. You're going on.
I stopped doing that.
You want to go? Go. You don't want to go? Don't go. You can afford to go? Go. You can't afford to go? Don't go.
All right.
The rest of it is just see what you're doing and then decide. I mean, if you think you need A, B, C, D, all these other X reasons to justify going, and just notice that habit. Oh, I need to justify that there's a bird refuge there and that there's a museum there, and I don't know if you're going to get to any of those, but
I don't want to. I really just want to spend time with these friends and not impose my aesthetic.
Okay, good.
I just want to go.
So decide if you want to go or don't go.
Okay.
See, being in a way, our practice is to see if we can be simple about things and to notice how we complicate what's simple sometimes in our holding to all sorts of sometimes unnoticed beliefs and attachments. And then we get into trouble. David.
Absolutely, I agree with, you know, we create our own suffering through situations, but I guess the inner sociologist in me has problems sometimes with situations where people are imposing on other people and controlling and abusing and oppressing mm-hmm. people, and those people who are oppressed or marginalized have every right seemingly to be angry. And is that a manifest? You know, you could take Holocaust, you could take slavery, you could take rich versus poor. You know, there's
yes.
all kinds of examples. But
and what's skillful and appropriate to do, and is anger skillful and appropriate? If it is, fine. If it isn't, fine. We don't have to go talk about theoreticals. The Dalai Lama has been dealing with a situation where his peoples are being subject to genocide on an ongoing basis. No doubt, I think it's very clear to see what's happening. And he's struggling with how to practice with that, given his role as the political and religious or spiritual leader of those people. So it's not only is it his own, but he's responsible and voicing and acting for them. So, you know, and he's practicing in accord with the Dharma. He's manifesting the Dharma. And it's a difficult situation and people are suffering. And you can see some monks are doing what's even more extreme in a way than what you're talking about by immolating themselves as a way of expressing their action, manifesting both their practice and their action. There isn't a formula. We each have to see, according to the conditions and circumstances that we are, what we have to do. This isn't a formula. This is saying, how do you practice the Dharma, the truth of the way it is? That doesn't mean that if someone comes at a knife with you, you say, oh, they're empty, the knife is empty, I'm empty, so I can be stabbed and it's no big deal. That's stupid. That's nonsense dharma. That's nonsense practice. That isn't functioning in the present moment. See, so this isn't about theory. This is about how do we manifest who and what we are each moment, functioning skillfully and appropriately. Those are just general words, but I think they're useful words for us if we can look at the situation and not be blinded by our, I'll use the word, preconceptions and attachments, but seeing what's so right now, being what's so right now, then we can hopefully act skillfully and appropriately. And some of that comes with making mistakes. Some of it comes with noticing where we get caught up, noticing where we get blinded. That's wisdom comes through living and through, oh, yeah, I didn't see that. I didn't realize how caught up I was about that when I did ABC, when I said that to that person. Or I didn't hear clearly because I was thinking about what I was going to answer to them. I knew what I was going to say to them before I met them, so I didn't hear and see where they were right now. Has that ever happened to anyone? Did you know in advance what you had to get that person to hear and know before they showed up in front of you? I have to hide. I will say that's exactly the opposite of what, at least from my side, in there. I never know who and what is showing up. And any time any idea arises, that's exactly my practice. And if I hold on to an idea, then I can't be doing that at that time.
I meant the opposite.
I know what you meant. I know what you meant. Fundamentally, what Bodhidharma is encouraging us here is to go beyond the habitual way of seeing and being who we are, and to see that if we go beyond that, we will discover who we have always been, who we always are, not something that we are going to gain, but we discover what our, if I say, birthright is, if I use that kind of word. Not something birthright to get, but our birthright in this moment. And if that comes about through therapy for people, wonderful. Because it doesn't require anything special or extra. Even such a thing called practice. That's exactly what he says. Even attachment to practice or accomplishment, we don't hold on to. See? There's nothing practiced. See, we have to see that there is nothing practiced. No thing called practice even to hold on to. No thing called pacified mind, heart to hold on to. No thing called true nature to stick. That's what we all have this opportunity.
Caught in the self-centered dream,
only suffering, holding the self-centered thoughts, exactly the dream. Each moment, life as it is, the only teacher. Being just this moment, compassion's way. Caught in the self-centered dream, only suffering, holding to self-centered thoughts, exactly the dream. Each moment, life as it is, the only teacher. Being just this moment.
Copyright 2013, Eliu Genmyo Smith.